Seneca 12, the years AD 49 to 50, the Empress Agrippina. Hi everyone, and welcome back to this podcast series on the life of Lucius Annaeus Seneca. It's now early AD 49 in Rome. The city is, by its own contemporary standards, huge and spectacular. The public building projects, begun under the great Augustus and continued by his descendants and successors, have created a stunning metropolis filled with imposing marble buildings. Fresh water flows in through aqueducts, themselves marvels of engineering, carried from hill lakes tens of kilometres away. But although all this architectural splendour is designed to impress, it's also intended to dominate and overawe, to provide a visual reminder to the city's million-plus inhabitants of exactly who's in charge here. The same effect is intended for visiting delegations from countries within and without the Roman Empire. Their first sight of the great city is a thoroughly overwhelming and intimidating experience. A visiting chieftain from the new province of Britannia, for instance, could not have imagined so much opulence on such a huge scale and would have entered into the curia, that's the Senate House, to present his credentials suitably cowed. To most of Europe, the North African countries on the Mediterranean Sea, and huge swathes of the Near and Middle East, Rome is the capital and undisputed master of the world. And it's to this sprawling and multicultural urban nerve centre, the seething anthill of humanity, that Lucius Annaeus Seneca was finally recalled in early AD 49, having spent 8 long years in exile on the island of Corsica. In terms of the wider empire, the political situation is relatively calm. There are some dynastic squabbles in Parthia, and the new province of Britannia is experiencing some teething violence as it settles under the Roman yoke. But by and large, there's not too much to trouble the Emperor Claudius, who is now in the 9th year of his reign, and still a fairly robust 58-year-old. Domestically too, things have settled down. The Empress Messalina, whose brazen infidelity to her husband had so damaged the reputation and prestige of the imperial household, is dead. And Claudius, after getting the law on incest swiftly altered to pave his way, has wedded his niece Agrippina, the last surviving daughter of his brother, the late and still lamented Germanicus. And it was Agrippina who'd been responsible for bringing Seneca back to the city that he so desperately missed. We learned in the last podcast that Agrippina had almost definitely maintained contact with Seneca during his long exile, and that his recall was, in no small part, due to his continued loyalty to her over the years. To all intents and purposes, Agrippina had become Seneca's patroness. So, in order to better understand Seneca himself, it's worth taking a bit of a closer look at this very formidable woman. It's likely Agrippina had, politically speaking, been playing the long game. She was definitely smart enough to carry it off. Once recalled by Claudius from exile in AD 41, she'd had the sense to keep her head down, unlike her sister, Julia Lavilla, whose open displays of affection to Uncle Claudius had incited Messalina to get her exiled and murdered. Agrippina herself had stayed away from the royal household, and, despite still attracting spite and animosity from Messalina, had managed to avoid any serious damage. The reason for Messalina's continuing targeting of Agrippina wasn't just because she was a favoured niece of Claudius. It was because Agrippina came with baggage. Baggage in the form of her son, Lucius Domitius Ahenobarbus, who'd been born in AD 37. The child had a pedigree going back through both his mother and father to the great Augustus, which made him a potential emperor and therefore a living threat to Britannicus, Messalina's own son with Claudius, who was 4 years younger than Agrippina's boy. The father of Agrippina's son, Gnaeus Domitius Ahenobarbus, had died in AD 41, and Claudius had Agrippina immediately remarried to Gaius Sallustius Crispus Passienus, but he too died in AD 47, and some say that Agrippina had that second husband poisoned in order to secure the inheritance for his son. Agrippina could see that Messalina's behaviour would always put her on a collision course with the Roman people, so she bided her time. From a distance, Agrippina watched, always careful not to display too much open fondness towards the emperor, always ensuring her own womanly reputation was beyond approach, and she simply waited for her rival to self-destruct, which of course Messalina inevitably did. Throughout the years AD 41 to 48, it was apparent that Agrippina was scheming. She obviously had an astute political mind, but as a woman, she could never hope to direct affairs unless perhaps as a voice behind the throne. Claudius, despite what the ancient commentators say, I think, was too long in the tooth, too bitten by past experiences, and he was actually too smart for Agrippina to hope to have much influence over him. But if she could somehow manage to put her own son on the throne, now that would be an entirely different matter. So, on what we nowadays call New Year's Day in the year AD 49, Claudius wedded Agrippina. As the new empress in an 8-year-old principate, there were some obvious obstacles in her way, and she wasted no time removing them. She was the new girl on the block, so she needed allies, people who were not too tied in with the existing power dynamic. And that's where Seneca came in. Agrippina and he had history together. He'd taken the fall when Agrippina's sister, Julia, was exiled, and he had no involvement with the local power factions in the city because he'd been languishing on Corsica for the previous 8 years. He was a learned man, or so he promoted himself in his previously published works, and so could be relied upon, or so she hoped, to tutor her son and guide the young man in a direction that would suit her own political ambitions. To consolidate her son's arrival in the imperial household, she organised for him to become betrothed to Claudius and Messalina's daughter, the 9-year-old Octavia, but only after first clearing the field by discrediting the girl's former fiancé. It's also suggested that Agrippina did away with any other potential rivals for Claudius's affections, such as Lollia Paulina, whom Agrippina accused of practicing black magic and had exiled and forced into committing suicide. Now, admittedly, much that's written about Agrippina's cloak and dagger carryings on comes from commentators writing at least a generation later, and even then under a different imperial dynasty, those commentators had their own axe to grind. So we have to be a bit careful not to accept everything they wrote about Agrippina, or about Seneca for that matter, at face value. But we also have to remember that being a member of a family in which multiple factions were continually jockeying for power was no easy thing, and it definitely wouldn't have made for a quiet night's sleep. Simply to survive in that environment, Agrippina had to be a hard-nosed bitch. And if she was to realise her ambitions for her son, as opposed to, say, Claudius' son Britannicus, she'd have to be utterly ruthless. Tacitus, arguably one of the more reliable ancient commentators, describes Agrippina as having, and I quote, a rigorous, almost masculine disposition. In public, Agrippina was austere and often arrogant. Her private life was chaste, unless power was to be gained. Her passion to acquire money was unbounded. She wanted it as a stepping stone to supremacy. At least that's what Tacitus says. Now, in my opinion, Seneca, as Agrippina's son's tutor, was in the thick of all of this from the start. Given the fragility of Agrippina's position, especially at the start of her career as empress, it's impossible to imagine Seneca being given free rein to teach the 11-year-old boy whatever he felt like. I think that Agrippina would have kept a very close eye on her son's education, insisting that he be taught statecraft to prepare him for the future. Whatever Seneca had done in the past to put himself into Agrippina's debt, her securing his recall from exile would have doubled that obligation. And Agrippina probably also played on Claudius' seeming unfairness towards Seneca and letting him get exiled, and then initially refusing to recall him. And that was in order to make Seneca aware just on which side his bread was actually buttered. So it's therefore also, for me anyway, difficult to imagine, given the history and closeness between Agrippina and Seneca, that he was not taken into her confidence right from the start as counsellor and co-conspirator. Seneca's reward for his loyalty was a praetorship, the political office junior only to the top job of consul. Agrippina also played on her popularity with the wider Roman people. AD 49 saw her raising her public profile, but AD 50 really saw her consolidating her position. She was given the title Augusta, thereby elevating her to the same prestige as the late Livia, the empress of the great Augustus and a paragon of womanly virtue. In another instance, that the captured British chieftain Caretacus, brought in chains to Rome and made to perform in what reads like a very orchestrated public ceremony designed to showcase Claudius's magnanimity, paid Agrippina equal homage to her husband as she sat alongside him on a raised dais. In addition, Agrippina's birthplace, the modern German city of Köln or Cologne, was made a Roman colony and named Colonia Claudia Ara Agrippinensium. In addition to securing the loyalty of her own creatures, such as Seneca, Agrippina had been making inroads into Claudius's close circle of freedmen. A bit earlier in the piece, she seems to have won over Pallas, the emperor's extremely influential treasurer, because it was he who'd organised the marriage of Agrippina to her uncle. Her recruiting Pallas as an ally paid off big time, because in that year of AD 50, He was instrumental in securing the formal adoption into the royal household of her son, Lucius Domitius Ahenobarbus. The boy was adopted by Claudius as Nero Claudius Caesar Augustus Germanicus, and he became known to history simply as Nero. Pallas had pointed out that the great Augustus himself had adopted his own stepson and ultimate successor, Tiberius, into the imperial family, so the precedent was both entrenched and auspicious. Yeah, but I'd imagine that around now, Britannicus, Claudius's natural son, but crucially younger than his stepbrother Nero by a few years, was becoming distinctly uncomfortable. So, Seneca was back in Rome. He held a high political post, that of praetor. He was tutor to a prince of the imperial household, and he was under the protection of the most powerful woman in the Roman Empire, Agrippina. It would seem then that for now he was content to keep to the background and just simply hitch a ride on Agrippina's rising star. We must also remember that Claudius was still around, and he was still steering the ship of Rome with a fairly steady hand. And Seneca was currently sitting too pretty to want to risk upsetting his own personal gravy train for the time being. Seneca was still, relatively speaking, a minor character in the imperial court, and so pretty much flew under the radar in those first few years with Agrippina as empress. But he does seem to have kept pretty much to himself in AD 49 and 50. There's no real record of him making waves in the Senate despite being a praetor, and he seems to have steered clear of any other scandal that might have brought him to the attention of the ancient commentators. What he did do, though, was write. It was around this time, when he was finally politically secure, that Seneca embarked upon some works that can only be described as philosophically purist. His De Constantia Sapientis, or On the Firmness of the Wise Man, and De Tranquillitate Animi, or On the Tranquillity of the Mind, are works that follow the conversion of the doubter to the Stoic way of looking at things, and then, once converted, his adherence to that way of life. Unlike the consolations that we looked at in earlier podcasts, there appears to be no political agenda lurking between the lines in these two works. The addressee, one Serenus, could be the same possible distant relative of Seneca's, who will become more important in later podcasts, so that detail is quite interesting. But to most readers, the two works are fairly standard treatises designed to attract recruits to the Stoic philosophical school. But the cynical side of my nature is nagging at me. Why did Seneca write these relatively bland works at this particular time? You know, like indeterminate shapes swimming below the surface of murky waters, a couple of possibilities are vaguely discernible. Firstly, I read them as Seneca proving his credentials as a valid tutor, a genuine tutor for his charge, the young Nero. At this point in Roman history, Stoicism was still a safe school, that's safe in inverted commas school, to belong to. It would be another decade or more before philosophical interference, specifically Stoic philosophical interference in politics, would become a perilous pastime. Around AD 50, though, It was the kind of thing that Seneca would have been expected to be teaching Nero. So by publishing these works, Seneca was proving to Claudius that he was happily doing his job. But that also made the publications part of the subterfuge or smokescreen that Agrippina, through Seneca, was throwing up around Nero to mask her true ambitions for the boy. As long as Claudius believed that Nero was being taught the bog-standard Stoicism that Seneca was publishing, he would be unlikely to suspect that the boy was being groomed for something altogether more ambitious and sinister. So we'll leave Seneca and Agrippina and Nero there for a while. The next podcast will look at the closing years of the reign of the Emperor Claudius, as Agrippina consolidates her hold on the inner circles of the court by enlarging her own power clique. And she also begins to manoeuvre for the end game, when she can at last supplant one fading emperor, her husband, with a dynamic new one, her son. I hope to see you there.